I'm Mark Golub, and in the news, the question of whether or not a man responsible for the pay-for-slave policy of the Palestinian Authority should be permitted to teach at Harvard University. In case anyone is unfamiliar with the phrase pay-for-slay, it refers to the Palestinian Authority's financially rewarding individual Palestinians and their families for murdering Israelis, for murdering Jews. The man credited with having established the fund used for pay-for-slay is the PLO's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat. And this spring, Saeb Erekat has been invited by Harvard to teach at its Center for Science and International Affairs for the current academic year. Well, one man who's been on the forefront of hunting Nazis in America is now petitioning the U.S. Attorney General's office to deny Saeb Erekat entry into the country to teach at Harvard. He's a prominent Manhattan attorney who also is representing the families of the 2009 Fort Hood massacre, in which 13 people were murdered and more than 30 were injured on that U.S. Army base by a man who seems to have had ties to Islamic extremism. His name is Neil Schur, and he is joining us now. And Neil, it is such a pleasure to welcome you back to JBS. It's wonderful to be with you again.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be back.
So, Neil, in your own words, tell me the story as you understand it. Why did Harvard invite a known sponsor of murder to teach a semester at its Center for Science and International Affairs?
Well, I think it's part of probably a broader problem that we see in academia throughout the United States, not just at Harvard. Everybody bows to the altar of academic freedom, the free exchange of ideas. That's what they say. Frankly, I think money is at the root of it.
Money. Harvard. You said money.
Money, yes. In fact, a report just came out within the last 2 days from the Department of Education, identifying how some of the, including Harvard, major institutions in this country, including my alma mater, Cornell, have not reported, as they're required to do, millions, possibly even billions of dollars received from foreign governments and from foreign entities. And that's a serious problem. It's not illegal to take that money, but you have to report it. And it's tied into a big problem that we're seeing, particularly with China. Also, it used to be with Saudi Arabia, that they ingratiate themselves to these institutions by giving big dollars. And you wind up with a person like Erekat, who becomes a senior fellow, I think that's the title that he was awarded, to teach. It's really offensive. And again, it's done in the name of academic freedom. But as you know, from my days when I was the head of the war crimes unit, I used to bar from entering in the United States, it was tens of thousands of criminals, SS men, etc. The most prominent, what I call watch listing, was of course Kurt Waldheim, the person who was the head of the UN and the president of Austria. And it occurred to me that the same law that barred Waldheim and other Nazi criminals could be used under different provisions to bar people who fomented terrorism, who endorsed it. And in the words of the immigration law, use their positions of prominence to advocate terror, totally contrary to American policy. And in the U.S. with Erekat, you talk about the pay for slay. Well, there's a law called the Taylor Force Law that was passed not that long ago, which essentially said that as long as the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, continues that policy, they will be deprived financial aid from the United States. And Erekat is he initiated it. He's the prime mover and the prime apologist. And he has attacked the Taylor Force Act. He has said that these terrorists, these Jew killers, it's all part of the Palestinian right to self-determination. And the fact that Harvard doesn't see that and gives him a pass, it's astounding. And there's a, yet another irony, and that is that his fellowship was attached to what's known as the Belfer Center at Harvard for scientific and political research. Now, the Belfer family is a family, the leaders of which were Holocaust survivors, extremely philanthropic in Jewish causes. I've known some of the Belfers over the years, and the idea that this person who endorses the murder of Israelis and Jews is cloaked in the glory of that center, it, to me, is as offensive as you can get.
Yes, but it's astounding to me, Neil. Neil, at one point when you were doing all of the work trying to keep, both trying to keep former Nazis out of America and also trying to find them, any of them who were in America, you did it as part of a larger organization. Are you doing this all on your own this time?
Well, essentially, yes. I am general counsel to a not-for-profit that advances terror victims. We've been involved in helping those, particularly Iranian-sponsored terror. It's a small not-for-profit. It doesn't raise money, and it's very aggressive. And I've been counsel to them, so I do that in conjunction with that. But also, it's part of, I guess it's in my DNA now, that I've been doing this for so long that I, it's just very important. And, you know, it's also part of a philosophy that's sort of I've developed for myself, and that is I've seen that, and you see this in academia in particular, that this idea of somehow the free exchange of ideas, that you sit down with your adversaries, like an Ericot and others, and you'll convince them of why they're wrong. You'll convince them that BDS is horrible. You convince them that it's not appropriate to delegitimize Israel. That doesn't work. It never has worked, and frankly, it never will work. And the ways to combat them, I believe, is to take strong and laser-like action, like trying to block Ericot from coming to the U.S. I've brought civil rights charges against NYU, and we got a tremendous resolution because of the anti-Semitic atmosphere, the horrific atmosphere on campus. The education department resolved a case with NYU in which NYU acknowledges that it will fight the broad definition of anti-Semitism, which is part of an executive order from the president, that identifies not just the so-called old-fashioned classic Jew hatred, but it goes further and says that there reaches a point where the delegitimization of Israel, where the attacks on Zionism to the point where, for example, you equate the IDF with the Nazis, where you deny the Holocaust, where you blame Jews and Israel for all the ills of the world. And we see this with COVID, Mark. We see it. It's the same old story that repeats itself. And the only way to deal with that, I believe, is not to sit down with these people. That has not worked. You know, in recent years, the anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere have been horrific. And as soon as one occurs, I'm deluged, as I'm sure you are and your viewers are deluged, by pleas from every Jewish organization. They're saying, we have been fighting anti-Semitism for the last 50 years. And we educate and we try to call attention to it. We've been doing it for so long, but anti-Semitism has never been worse than it is now, never since the 1930s.
Why is
And I
that?
said to
What?
was that when I say to myself, that's an admission of failure. If you've been advocating against anti-Semitism for so long, and it's the worst now, clearly what you've been doing is not working. Go ahead.
In what sense, Neil, do you mean it's worse now?
Well, this is what these organizations are saying. They, you know, the typical line is we haven't seen anything like this since the 1930s in Europe.
But Jews, what is the this that we have not seen since the 1930s?
Well, first of all, particularly in Europe, you have violence. You had it in Pittsburgh. You see.
But wait a minute.
Challenging.
Pittsburgh was not the first time a Jewish institution was the victim of some lunatic. We had it done in Kansas City. We've had it done in L.A. And obviously, we had it after Pittsburgh. There was something in California, but I don't think that. I'm surprised someone used that as an example of it being worse now than ever before, when there have been more shootings than we've seen even lately.
I know. Oh, Mark, I agree with you completely. What I am doing is simply articulating what these organizations, the so-called defense organizations, are saying. That, frankly, I'll be very crass about it. It's for fundraising. Look, that's, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. That's what it is. And, you know, I mentioned before, a little earlier, that you sort of have to follow the money. And when it comes to what's going on campuses, and frankly, groups like the Students for Justice in Palestine, which was created by the Muslim Brotherhood, they are responsible for all of the anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist, anti-Israel activities on campuses, large and small,
absolutely,
all over the country. And I've got to tell you, I'm sorry to say, excuse me, they are much better organized than the Jews on campus. Much better. I've seen their their national instructions. They've got it together, and they've been able to intimidate university administrators who won't shut them down. I think the only way to deal with them, you have to go after that Students for Justice in Palestine. And frankly, I'm not prepared to give specifics, but I've been looking into that, because that is the head of the monster, without a doubt. And unless action is taken against them, it's not going to get better.
But it's interesting. Many, many American Jews don't even know what SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, is. Just explain to the audience why it is such an insidious, horrific movement. And it's not, Bowie, it is not on 100% of our college campuses, but it is on major college campuses with high profiles. But explain what SJP really is.
Well, SJP, I mean, as I said, it was created by the Muslim Brotherhood, but they will advance anti-Israel demonstrations. There was something used to be called Apartheid Week, maybe it still is, on major campuses in Berkeley, in Duke, all the Ivy Leagues. And their tactics are very harassing. They'll have these demonstrations, these tables giving out this terrible propaganda. And when Jewish students walk by, they're harassed. Some of the times it gets physical. They have meetings all the time. They advance BDS. They are responsible for resolutions, which some pass, some don't, endorsing BDS, going after Israel. There have been situations where pro-Israel speakers have been sort of shoved off of podiums, not allowed to speak. It's gotten ugly. It went on at NYU, which parenthetically has some of its major contributors, prominent Jewish philanthropists. And the same can be said for so many universities. I mentioned the Belfers at Harvard. And it's one of the problems at the university is that the SJP, they are relentless. They keep going. If you look at them the wrong way, they demonstrate, they advocate, and they harass. And when students complain to the university, they'll sit down, well, we'll have meetings, we'll talk, all of which is an effort to try to kick the can down the road, knowing that the complaining students, within a matter of time, are going to be off campus. They're going to graduate. They're going to leave. And that's their objective. At NYU, we had a terrific student who graduated, but she did not let go of the fight. The result of which was a tremendous resolution where NYU has adopted this international definition of anti-Semitism. And they have to take steps, and the education department will be monitoring it to try to clean up this hostile environment that permeates the campus.
Yeah, my own feeling, Neil, is that that is the hotbed of anti-Semitism in America today. And then there's this discussion, if one is anti-Israel, is it anti-Semitic? And the answer is, in most instances, obviously yes. But it seems to me that the place where American Jewry has to be most concerned with anti-Semitism is not on the streets, but is on the college campuses. I'm going to come back in a moment to ask you a philosophical question related to everything you've just said. But I don't want to lose the train of thought here about your attempt to keep Arakat out of the United States and out of Harvard. You went to the Attorney General of the United States. I'm curious to know what reaction you've received.
Well, I didn't get a formal reaction, and frankly, I didn't expect it. When I was in the Justice Department for 15 years, people would write to me about someone they thought was a Nazi criminal or what have you. And the government's response, law enforcement, prosecutors' response is neither to confirm nor deny. But the letter to Arafat got an awful lot of publicity. And so I have no doubt that it's being considered. Now, there is an extraneous event that took place, and that is Arafat sounds like he's deathly ill in, of all places, Hadassah Hospital.
Yes,
it's in Jerusalem, right. with COVID. Yeah. Which itself became very controversial, as you can imagine.
In Israel,
yes.
The question is, why is Hadassah Hospital treating someone who basically is the architect of pay for slay? And the answer that Hadassah gives is, that's how Jews operate, and we even will take care of, you know, Mahmoud Abbas's mother, Mahmoud Abbas's brother, and Arakat. It happens to be, in my mind, an aspect of Israeli culture and of a Jewish culture that should make Jews very proud. But you're correct. He's in a Hadassah hospital, and it has been controversial on the Israeli scene.
Yeah, I mean, many families of terror victims, you know, they demonstrated. You know, you can understand that.
Absolutely. It's also, absolutely.
You know, and someone was very blunt. They said, he's taking up a hospital spot. He has COVID now. That's who he's being treated for. Taking up a bed that could be for an Israeli.
But your point is, therefore, the issue is not as pressing.
Right. Arakat, 2 years ago, got a lung transplant in a Virginia hospital right outside of Washington, D.C. We allowed him in to get a transplant. And yet, he's been highly critical of the U.S. He was highly critical of the law, which is supposed to prevent the pay for slay. I also have no doubt that if he recovers now and he goes back to Ramallah, his hometown, he will continue to be critical of Israel and the United States. There's no doubt in my mind about it.
Okay. By the way, you know, in some way, this reminds one of 1988 when the Reagan administration Secretary of State George Shultz denied Yasser Arafat a visa to enter the United States to speak at the United Nations because of the terrorism and murder perpetrated by the PLO, including the murder of Leon Klinghoffer, who was murdered in his wheelchair and then pushed off the deck of the Italian cruise ship, the Achille Lauro. But we remember very well when Arafat was denied entry into the United States.
Yeah. Although he did come, you know, after the famous 1993 handshake on in the White House, he came to the States.
Yes.
And, you know, in 1994, I became the head of AIPAC. And I've got to tell you that, in essence, after that, the Oslo Accords, in effect, the organized Jewish community was lobbying for Arafat to give them money. And I lost sleep over that, I've got to tell you. But that's the way Washington worked. And one last little anecdote about that, about Arafat and Oslo. About 3 weeks or so before he was assassinated, there was a Shabbat dinner in New York at the Regency Hotel on Park Avenue, where Israeli high-level delegations routinely stayed. And it was, they said, a beautiful Shabbat dinner, and I came up from Washington to attend it. And after the dinner was over, I remember Elie Wiesel was there, prominent rabbis and political leaders. I actually sat next to, I think it was Mort Zuckerman. It was a beautiful evening. And as I'm leaving, as everybody is walking out, I had to cut through the bar to go to the elevator to go to my room. And somebody called my name, and it was Yitzhak Rabin. We had actually been working in Washington on something that week. And he called me over. He was basically by himself, although he had his security around him. And I remember he said to me, you know, I'm having a hard time sleeping. I don't know. I don't know whether I did the right thing. I don't know if I could ever trust that Arafat. You know, that stuck in my mind, obviously. And I said a few weeks later, he was assassinated. So
that's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you now the philosophical question.
Okay.
You know, you spoke a moment ago about how SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, which you've said twice, and I think most people are unaware of it, were basically created by the Muslim Brotherhood. And the question is, will the United States ever play footsie with the Muslim Brotherhood again? But you're talking about how the SJP is trying to stifle Jews from speaking on college campuses. I'm guessing, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, we've known each other a long time, that you are an advocate of the First Amendment and that you're an advocate of free speech. Am I correct?
Of course. Absolutely.
Of course.
Okay.
Well, when you say, when you're critical of SJP for stopping pro-Israeli speakers from speaking, and at the same time you are trying to stop Erica from speaking at Harvard, how do you in your own mind draw a line where free speech is protected, and even if people that you and I don't like, are we prepared to give them the right to free speech? And I'm asking this question of you, Neil, in a context where in American society, there are serious assaults against free speech, and where the major tech corporations, the Googles and the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the Twitters, all feel they have a right to decide what speech should be available through their platforms or not. So it goes beyond now the college campus. But for anybody who would say to you, well, you're being hypocritical, Neil Schur. On the one hand, you want to stop Erekat. On the same time, you're critical of SJP for wanting to stop whom they disagree with. How do you deal with this personally? How would you help our audience understand where a line is appropriate or inappropriate?
Yeah, a number of points. First of all, no one is stopping Erekat from speaking. He speaks.
Wait a minute. You're trying to keep him from entering the United States.
Well, that's right. And that's
so that
and
he
that's
won't
entirely...
be able to be a professor at Harvard.
That's
and
right.
And by the way, and I'm sympathetic to that, but I'm also concerned from my own perspective. I am adamant that the First Amendment must be inviolate. And so I'm almost asking you to help me understand.
Yeah, I understand.
My own ambivalence here.
Well, first of all, freedom of speech has never, ever been absolute. I think people have to understand that. There are always limitations. For example, we have in this country defamation laws, slander laws. You can't just go around denigrating people, you know, and there are legal nuances to that, whether someone is a public figure and what have you. But there also is an understanding under our laws that when you advocate for blatant criminal activity, there's a correlation between advocacy and actually carrying out those deeds. And I'm particularly sensitive to that from my experiences as a war crime prosecutor. I prosecuted and kicked out of the United States a number of individuals who were propagandists under the Nazi regime. It became very clear, it was clear since Nuremberg, that the propagandizing of Jew hatred and calling for the destruction of Jews has consequences, and it leads to actual destruction. Now, in terms of what's going on campus with SJP, there's a difference between criticizing Israel. I mean, my goodness, some of the biggest critics of Israel are Israelis. But there comes a point where your actions are not just speaking. You are preventing others from speaking. I mentioned sometimes it even gets physically, physical hostility. People have been hurt. And, you know, there is a comment many decades ago in the United States Supreme Court about the Constitution. And it's something that's been reiterated over the years. And that is the Constitution is not a suicide pact. That had to do with some alien and sedition laws going way back. But even Arthur Goldberg, a great civil libertarian, affirmed that notion. And, you know, there is, of course, an intrinsic value to being able to speak your mind, and no one can deny that. But there comes a point when the intention of that is not to convince other people, but really to do serious harm and damage.
I appreciate the distinction very, very much. By the way, I've appreciated your work and who you are for years and years and years. I love what you do. I love talking to you. We haven't talked enough, so we'll do more of it. In the meantime, I wish you kol tov v'hatzlacha. Neil Shure, you do fabulous work for not only the Jewish community, but for America as a whole. Thank you for giving us some time on JBS.
Mark, my pleasure. All the best. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Neil Shure, a longtime Nazi hunter who is now seeking to prevent the Palestinian leader responsible for funding the pay-for-slave policy of the Palestinian Authority to enter the country to teach a semester at Harvard. I hope you found his insights enlightening, as I did. As always, my thanks to our director, Sloan Copeland, JBS Managing Director, Dara Golub, Transmission Manager, John McDevitt, and to the producer of In the News, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Be well, my friends.